Cunningham, architect Charles Luckman, television and radio personality Art Linkletter, the Nobel Prize winner, father of the Green Revolution, Norman Borlaug, Dr. Louis S. B. Leakey, the anthropologist, inventor William Lear, the wife of the late civil rights leader Merle Evers, and the photographer and conservationist Ansel Adams. In addition to today's speaker, who is the only convocation speaker thus far invited for a repeat performance, Cal Poly's convocation series will bring two distinguished speakers to the campus within the next few weeks. A week from this coming Thursday at 11 a.m., that's Thursday, January 17th, our speaker will be Secretary of Agriculture Earl Butts. He was scheduled two times previously and had to cancel for reasons that you may know if you read the newspapers, but we're quite sure he's going to make it this time. At 11 a.m. on Thursday, February 7th, Mayor Alioto of San Francisco is scheduled to speak to us about the energy crisis. Incidentally, he... Believe it or not, the invitation was extended to Mayor Alioto last August. Today's speaker, who is jointly sponsored by the Student Council of the School of Communicative Arts and Humanities, will be introduced by a representative of that group, a young lady from South Pasadena, a journalism major here at Cal Poly, who is planning to receive her bachelor's degree here this June. I think she's going to make it. Her GPA this last quarter was 4.0. That means a straight A. So I think she's going to make it. Besides being a top student, this young lady has done some other interesting and worthwhile things, a few that I'll share with you now. She was a homecoming princess when she went to high school in South Pasadena. She also rode on a winning Rose Parade float. She's a member of the Mustang Daily staff. She's a press club member. She's the promotional assistant for the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce. That is, she writes news releases for the Chamber of Commerce and has edited the Chamber of Commerce newspaper. The person who is to introduce today's distinguished convocation speaker is Candy Irving. Candy. That applause is for you.
Thank you, Dr. Andrews. Good morning. As residents of this county, we are all very familiar with the Hearst name. Not only is the famous Hearst Monument located in the north part of our county, but one of San Luis Obispo County's most distinguished residents who bears the Hearst name has become a man of national prominence. Our guest, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, is one of the most widely traveled newspaper men in the world. Just recently, he has returned from a global trip, which included a month-long visit to China and the Asian countries bordering the Pacific. Our speaker began his journalistic career in 1928 as a reporter for the New York Journal American. He served as a correspondent during World War II for that newspaper, covering such events as the landing at Normandy. Returning from the war, our guest served as publisher of the Journal American and as publisher of the American Weekly Magazine and Puck, the Comic Weekly. Following the death of his father, founder of the vast Hearst Empire, our speaker became editor-in-chief of the Hearst newspapers and began writing a weekly column, Editor's Report. His nationwide enterprise consists of the Los Angeles Herald Examiner, the San Francisco Examiner, the Baltimore News American, the Boston Herald American, the Albany News Times, the Knickerbocker News Union Star, the San Antonio Light, and the Seattle Post Intelligencer. In addition to being an outstanding journalist, our speaker has been personally acquainted with seven United States presidents, Mr. Roosevelt, Mr. Hoover, Mr. Truman, Mr. Eisenhower, Mr. Kennedy, Mr. Johnson, and Mr. Nixon. This gentleman, who describes himself as a San Luis Obispo rancher, serves as chairman of the board of the Hearst Corporation, which still operates the Hearst Ranch at San Simeon. He also serves on other various boards, including United Press International and the Inter-American Press Association. On behalf of the university and the School of Communicative Arts and Humanities, I am proud to welcome back for a second visit Mr. William Randolph Hearst, Jr.
Thank you. Sandy was saying that she was nervous and had stage fright. So have I. I don't think it's right, really, basically, for a guy to stand up and inflict his views on a lot of other people, but this is your doings, you know. You asked me here. Or rather, Bob Kennedy did. President Kennedy did. Excuse me. Got to remember where I put that. And so I'm here. A lot of what Candy said is probably true. I have traveled a lot. I like it. I recommend it to all of you. Horace Greeley once said, "Go West." He was a famous editor of the last century. "Go West, young man," about the time that California was discovering gold, or subsequently. And if I could edit that, I'd just say, go, travel. It's great for you. You get to know people and peoples, and there's a difference. And you get to know their problems, and you see things at first hand. And then when you come home, you're automatically kind of a big shot because they want to know what you think of this and that and the other. You may not know what they asked you. You may not know the answers. But sometimes you do, and you must learn. You can't go any place without liking it, without seeing something new, without seeing something that stirs your own mind and brain, and you come away better off for it. Now, looky, I'm supposed to be well known, but nothing like my father, and in his day, my grandfather. So if you don't mind, let me just go back to them for a little bit. Some of the folks here probably know them better than some of you younger ones. This is just the wrong distance. You can read with them or without them, but not well with either. The first Hearst was my grandfather, George Hearst. No middle name in those days to speak of. He came from Missouri, where he'd done a little mining, in 1850 when he was 30. He was interested in mining there, and when he heard of the strikes here, why, he just plain took off across the continent. Unlike a lot of Americans, really, who came out thinking they were going to pick it up on the gold on the ground, he knew something about it, as I say, and he managed to get by for a little while, and then, little by little, he really hit it big. First with the Comstock Lode in Nevada, subsequently with some big mine in Ontario, I think it was in Utah, later in Montana with a little copper job called the Anaconda, and then finally in South Dakota with something that's a household word pretty near, and that's the Homestake. Now, he didn't own these, but as a, he'd be what you call a mineralogist, I guess, today, although he didn't know the word, I don't suppose, and it wasn't much used. But he knew rocks, and they used to bring him rocks, guys, friends of his, miners, and say, "George, what do you make of this?" And if he said, I make pretty good of it, they'd dig. And if they dug and found anything, they cut him in. Now, this is a pretty good way of being a miner, and it's cleaner. But nevertheless, he did it the hard way, too, I can tell you that. In Bill Swanberg's book, Citizens Hearst, he said, speaking of George Hearst, that he possessed the three prerequisites of the pioneer: strength, courage, and ingenuity. 10 years after he got here and he'd hit it pretty good, he went back and married a girl 20 years his junior, Phoebe Apperson, from Missouri. She was a school teacher, a truly remarkable woman, my grandmother, who dedicated her life to the rearing of her son, William Randolph Hearst, my father, who was born in San Francisco, and the schools and education of every conceivable sort, starting with kindergartens. She founded the PTA with another lady. She restored George Washington's home in Mount Vernon when she went east with her husband, who became a senator from California, and started the St. Cathedral School for Girls in Washington. She laid out an architectural competition for the University of California and became the godmother, practically, of the Berkeley campus. libraries, wherever they went, with Anaconda Homestake or up in Butte, Montana, there are kindergartens and libraries that are Hearst libraries. It's all her doings. They used to tease Grandpa Hearst because he didn't have anywhere near the education, apparently, that she did. When he went to the Senate, some wisecracker said, you know, he don't have much education. He says, he spells bird, B-U-R-D. And George Hearst got up and says, well, if B-U-R-D don't spell bird, what the hell do it spell? So that put an end to that line of reasoning. Now, against such a family background, with a lot of dough behind it, it's obvious that Pop could have had a career in mining or finance or business, industry, education. But his one interest, he's just absolutely nuts about it, and nobody knows where it came from, was newspapers. It didn't come from the fact that his father owned the little paper in San Francisco called The Examiner, because he got that for a bum debt. And it was about what it was worth. It was a kind of a throwaway thing, a little house organ to tout the local Democratic Party or the Republican Party or whoever owned it, if he was running for anything. And Pop wanted it more than anything. Now, Grandpa Hearst took a dim view of this at the beginning, but when he was elected, or appointed rather, to the United States Senate from California, he relented. And on that same day, March 4th, 1887, the same day that George Hearst was sworn in as a senator in Washington and left San Francisco to live in Washington, William Randolph Hearst took over the Examiner. I guess he waited till his Pop got out of town, you know, to do this thing. Anyway. In a letter to his father, my father wrote, we must be alarmingly enterprising and we must be startlingly original. This will be interesting to the journalistic students, I hope. It's good stuff. We must be honest and fearless. We must have greater variety than we have ever had. We must print more matter than we have ever printed. We must increase our force and enlarge our editorial staff. His letter in full is printed in a book published by Simon & Schuster and edited by them, called A Treasury of the World's Great Letters. And in that book, he's in awful good company. Guys like Aristotle and Plato and people like that. This is a wonderful letter. Really, every journalistic student should read it. He became a great influence in American life, as some of the older fellows here and ladies will know. He was an authentic genius of American journalism. At his high point, he was probably one of the most powerful men. He owned about 25 newspapers from one end of the country to the other. He, among other things, and some people downgrade this, but they make a mistake, he influenced our going into liberating Cuba from Spain. Today, that would be considered a very noble gesture. Imperialistic Spain and these poor little Cubans and all like that. Well, that's just the way he saw it, because he was very liberal himself. And so he whooped it up down there when they sank one of our battleships, and he and Teddy Roosevelt had themselves a ball. It was a very short war. It was pretty one-sided. Spain was too far away to do much about it, and in no time at all, the Cubans were free. Look at the damn thing now, you know, kind of thing. But in any case, he plunked for and put across a Senate, constitutional amendment for the popular election of senators, women's suffrage, and the repeal of prohibition. I don't know where he stood on having prohibition, but he was for the repeal of it, and he didn't drink much either, as a matter of fact. He also played a key role in the nomination of Franklin Roosevelt, by swinging the pivotal states, this state, California, and Texas. For swinging Texas, Garner became the vice president. So in those days, and as throughout American politics, deals were made. When Pop died in 51, I suddenly was thrust into the role of editor-in-chief of the Hearst newspapers, a post he had held since the 1880s, and felt at the time, as Harry Truman said, he felt when President Roosevelt died in office and he became the president, that the stars and the moon and all the planets had fallen in on me. His was a hard act to follow, for my father had been the founder, the creator of our newspapers, and our type of journalism, the Hearst magazines, radio and television division, the Hearst real estate properties, King Features, the world's largest news service, feature service, a newsreel, a motion picture company, real estate, I can't tell you. All I could hope to do, and all I have dedicated myself to doing, is to carry on in his tradition and name. Now, since I had an avid interest, having been raised in our business and what was going on in our world, I decided, along with my other home duties, to write a weekly column and report from all over the globe on developments that affected both directly and indirectly the future of our country. With this concept in mind, I formed the Hearst Task Force, just strictly on the basis that three heads are better than one. And they are, it turned out. We'd talk among ourselves, we'd interview the same guy, and we'd come away with different views and different notes, and the result was better. In 1955, I'd been a war correspondent, and I liked traveling. It got in my blood. And I'll tell you this, it beats the hell out of sitting in an office, too, particularly in New York. It's not so bad the way Pop had it. He used to sit up at San Simeon and run the whole works from there. It's a better arrangement. On that first trip to Russia, 1955, with Kingsbury Smith, our chief of our international news service over there in Europe, and the late Frank Kniff, my friend and war correspondent, we became the first American correspondents to interview Khrushchev, Premier Bulganin, Marshal Zhukov, and Foreign Minister Molotov. Now, at that time, word of honor, Molotov was the only one, the foreign minister was the only one whom all the foreign embassies saw in Moscow. And for some reason or other, because they asked us there, a visa, an invitation, a visa is nothing but an invitation, which I only just got one to Peking the other day. You can't go in anybody's country unless they've got no visa requirements, most, without them giving you this thing. So they wanted us to come up there. And we couldn't have interviewed these fellas. We didn't knock down their doors. You'd have a tough time doing it in Moscow or any dictatorship, or even our own country, I'd hope, unless they wanted you to. They wanted to give themselves this exposure through the Hearst papers. And boy, it sure fit in with our plans, I'll tell you that, because that's why we went. At the time of Stalin's death, a little fellow named Malenkov had been named premier. But by the time we arrived there, it was pretty well established that Khrushchev, who was the head of the party, incidentally, and in any communist setup, the head of the party is not necessarily the head of state, and he's the boss. Khrushchev was not too well known then, but when the reason we got wise to is to the importance of his job, frankly, was because he was the only one of the guys who, when we sat down, he didn't say. He was the one who turned around and said, shut the phones off. And he had a red one and a green one and a blue one, this kind of thing. The other guys don't do that because the boss may call. So we knew we were talking to the boss. It was a matter of sheer deduction. But he used on us for the first time the expression competitive coexistence between the East and the West. For our reporting of this and of these, of the fellas that we saw, all of them, we got the Pulitzer Prize. Now, I don't know whether old man Pulitzer would have revolved in his grave at the idea of having a Hearst win his prize, because they were highly competitive in New York, but we were awful proud to get it, I'll tell you that. It's the top journalistic prize in the country. Now, as a result, strangely enough, I never thought a commie would do me a favor like this, but as a result of these interviews in Russia, which were printed all over the world, it opened the doors to every country around the world for us by invitation, possibly suggestion about it. But I mean, we got in to see everybody. Mrs. Hearst, Austin, and I went around the world the next year with my brother, Bob Considine, Frank Kniff, and Kingsbury Smith. We stayed with Magsaysay, then the president of the Philippines. Went over to Korea and saw President Reed, the royal family, if you please, and the Prime Minister of Japan, Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek in Taiwan, Nehru in India, Ben-Gurion in Israel, Adenauer in Germany, and that great Winston Churchill in England. He had been a friend. He'd been a friend of my father, so that wasn't such a trick. But it was the biggest treat of all. Believe me, there was a man. I returned to the Soviet Union again later, a couple of years later, in the end of 57, with Frank and Bob Considine. Once again, we interviewed Khrushchev and Bulganin, and the cast was different now. They had moved Malenkov out while we were there the first time and put Bulganin in. We interviewed him as they called us back from Leningrad as we were leaving. And there was a new foreign minister, Gromyko, and a guy named Malinovsky who had taken Zhukov's place. Beetle-browed guy, you may remember him, a very tough guy. He was the Minister of Defense. Each year since then, we've tried to do the same thing. We go around the world. I've been around, I guess, half a dozen times. I swear I don't know for sure. And if there were scalps, on our belt, why, I guess you'd start with the Pope and Ben-Gurion, General Diane, Goldie Meir, of course, Foreign Minister Abba Eban, all of them from Israel, Nasser in Egypt when he was there, Diem in South Korea when he was there, President Chu and Ki since then. I was in Vietnam 6 times during the war. Prime Minister Sato in Japan, Mrs. Gandhi. Now, these faces change in these countries almost as fast as they do here, boy. Don't ever let them tell you that we change any more than they do. Except ours get out alive, and theirs are very often strung up or in some unmarked graves. Betancourt, Pompidou, Willie Brandt was mayor of Berlin when I first went up. It was kind of spooky, too, at that time. They'd broken out, and later now he's the prime minister of Germany. The last half a dozen presidents of Mexico, and during my lifetime, I guess, as Candy told you, half a dozen or 7 presidents of the United States. I don't mean to be name-dropping, but people who are in a responsible job have always interested me. I can get a lot of free advice, as we all can, in any given saloon. It's free, too. You don't have to travel very far, at least I don't. I have to travel further than you do. I live out in San Simeon where they don't have any. But the irresponsibility of opinion is one of the things that we enjoy in this country. I don't want to make a separate speech added to this one, but that's why I do like to talk to guys who, when they do say something, it generally means that his country stands for that, or he's going to make it stand for it, and it's really worth listening to. In our own presidency, as I said, I have known by their first names, which you're not allowed to call them. And I certainly didn't know Roosevelt by that first name, and I knew Herbert Hoover in the Grove, and nobody ever called him Herbert. I guess the last person was his mother. But Harry Truman didn't have any other name but Harry. Dwight Eisenhower, nobody called him anything but General. Jack Kennedy, LBJ, and Richard Nixon. Dick Nixon, we knew him, Bootsy and I, as a congressman, when he came to town with a couple of little gals about that big. We had 2 boys about that big. Now they're about this big. We developed perhaps a technique, and that is of following people, our presidents particularly, and our top people, after they make a trip around the world. It's like following a candidate. If you're on the train, they give you a handout. Everybody gets the same handout. If you stay in the town where they've been, you can listen a little bit and talk to the locals, and you get an idea of what the impression the guy made. And so you literally learn something a little more. And I think his own people probably do that too. They should if they don't. They'd be surprised what they hear. But we did it back behind Jack Kennedy once in Europe, and we did it behind Nixon a couple of years ago in Asia, when he first went to China, that was it. Now, I've been trying to get in China, I guess, for a couple of years. The regular route, just put your name up, and there's been something the matter with the postal system, because I haven't gotten any answer. Until this time, we started to go around, I thought I would, behind Kissinger. through the Middle East and then on to Peking. And I thought if I stuck close enough to his coattails and yet not in his party, that if there was an empty seat on his plane, I'd get on it. And then he couldn't very well say, I don't know this guy, because he does. Well, it almost worked like that, except he went in by another way than I got in, and I got hung up in Hong Kong and wrote that funny thing happened to me while I was on my way to Peking, that my visa didn't show. Whereupon there was a fuss and a stumbling around and a buzzing in the State Department, because this apparently embarrassed them, or they took it as an embarrassment, thank heaven, and got scratching. And within a week, I got notified that this thing was coming through for the task force, which we'd applied to for about almost a year before. I didn't know they knew Joe was with me. Kingsbury Smith happened to be with me, but not a third member, which we could have brought in just as easily as not. Now, another clincher was that David Bruce, who is our representative up there — they don't call him an ambassador, but we do because he's been an ambassador to the three big countries in Europe, France, Germany, and England. He's our top diplomat. I met him during the war in Europe, that is. There's been a few since. But he's a wonderful man. He really, truly is. Wise and kindly and humorous, and he's just got everything. So he said, well, if you get in, use my name if you want. I can't do anything about it. I'm not supposed to be there, practically. I'm not an ambassador to them yet. Just a representative or some name for it, head of the delegation or something. But he said, you stay with me if you get in. So dropping names helps even with the communists sometimes, because I just said, my God, I'm a house guest of David Bruce. He's our ambassador there. Oh, why didn't you say so? So I should have said I just left the house and lost my way, you know, or something like that. I'd gotten in sooner, probably. Now, we didn't see the two top Chinese characters, Mao or, you know, name skips me. Anyway, but we did see representatives of the Foreign Office, the director of the China News Agency, which is like Pravda and does all the propaganda, the chief of the Foreign Press Division, members of the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party, and a fellow who, in the Foreign Office, whose job is to handle the Russians. Handle the Russians, I mean, he handles the border dispute primarily, which has been going on for several years. I found this, that the Chinese people, for one thing, are far more open and friendly. By this, I mean even no setup. If you walk along the street, or if you're in a museum, or if you're in a whatever, a library or what, and there's anything to smile about, or if there's a little kid and you smile at the kid, they're very, very, very frank and friendly. The Russians are more dour, and I don't know whether it's worth it. But I tell you this, you need have no doubt, and you can take this from me and you can ask anybody who's been, that the dispute currently between the Soviet Union and China is very real and bodes for a great deal at some time or another. I don't think they're going to start shooting at each other, but they don't have any particular use. And I'll develop it a little bit. I did on Sunday. If you all, I'm sure you do read the Sunday Examiner. It has a Chronicle in it as well as an added attraction. Now, the Chinese, literally, though, now, while they'll just tell you that they don't trust him, and this is a high guy talking, this is something that they don't generally do on that level, unless they don't care about being quoted, and they didn't. They have an almost obsessive fear of being attacked by the Soviet Union, and they are convinced, as I am, that world domination is the ultimate aim of Soviet policy. But they say this. They say, we don't think we're next on their list. We think Europe is next on their list. Europe and or the Arab oil states. Because if they can neutralize — they didn't say through oil at that, this was the week or so before this thing happened — but they said if they can neutralize Europe and control the oil, which keeps Europe running and NATO running and Japan running, then if they then turn towards us why we could have all the PACs in the world and you couldn't do us much good. And I'm glad to say we have not got a PAC that says we have to run to China's assistance, but even if we did have, we would be alone doing it, and I, for one, hope we don't get one, because we're just biting off there more than we could chew for fair, which we've done in the past. It is because of this fear, I think, that the Chinese, after living in isolation from the rest of the world so long, 25 years, actually, from the time Mao took over, decided to open their doors to President Nixon, Secretary of State Kissinger, and a variety of other visitors, including ourselves. They believe, as I do, that we cannot and should not trust, as I say, the Soviets. They know, as I know, that the tense situation involved with China and ties in directly to the conflict in the Middle East, and I've done that. This is what happens when I ad lib around here, because I get ahead of myself. But it's all one and the same. When I got home, Cy Frieden, who is our London correspondent, but who'd been up in Geneva, to show you how far this has gone, had a story, I've got it in my overcoat, in which he quoted a Russian source in Geneva, where he'd been for the Israeli and Egyptian peace talks. The Russian probably got a little soused, because I don't think he talked this way. He said that they would incinerate. They would incinerate China if they didn't make sense or if they got tough. Use that word, and use this word, they'd make a crematorium of them down there. Well, down there, China is under the part of Russia that, as you know, runs over to the Pacific, Siberia and all. So those quotes were definitely, this Tsai is a former head of foreign correspondent of the Herald Tribune, as well as now head of our London office, and he's a very dependable guy. He doesn't have to write this stuff to get in the paper. They made clear that they would employ their nuclear superiority over China if they were to reach a point where they felt they had to subdue the Peking regime, which has the largest army in the world and a nuclear capability of its own. They also point out that all of the Chinese rockets are pointed towards them, which they are. I'm glad to hear. I think it's fairly obvious that China probably is on their list, because they couldn't very well dominate the world without dominating China. They wouldn't be easy to subdue on the ground, but they wouldn't be too tough to surround and neutralize is the word I was fishing for. They also, honest, in my opinion, and this does affect us, not as much as the rest of the world and all of our allies, but it would isolate us if they chose. If they ran that whole Middle Eastern oil situation the way a country who wants to dominate the rest of the world could do, Well, for one thing, we'd probably miss the next war because we couldn't get in it. That'd be the only good thing I can think about. But they would neutralize Europe because they need the oil, as Japan does. There wouldn't be any free world except ourselves and possibly South America for a while. But, Europe is a regular Tower of Babel. There are a dozen or so countries there. There are a lot of different languages spoken. There are a lot of different national interests. And just as they've already begun to break off and make concessions to the Arabs, meaning that they'd be less friendly or alienate entirely the Israelis, they have their own national interests that they have to look after on the one hand. They cannot sometimes put principle or even a treaty ahead of their own survival. It's a tough one. I don't mean to prejudge them. It so happens we can get along without that Middle Eastern oil, and we will. But that's going to be your job. I'm speaking now to the students and not to the first half a dozen rows down here. Joe Alsop wrote the same thing 2 weeks ago, not the same thing, but from a different angle, that Moscow is seeking to reopen the Suez Canal. That's the reason they're down there wanting to make peace. They generally like troubled waters. They fish in them. You let you and him fight kind of thing. But if they can open the Suez Canal, it's only 2,000 miles out to the Indian Ocean instead of the 11,000 around Africa. The aim of the Soviets, wrote Joe Alsop, is to cement beyond challenge the air and naval bases which it has succeeded in deploying to surround the Arabic Peninsula. When and if that happens, the Russians will have almost complete domination of the Arab nations and will be able to call the shots on how and where they ship their oil. Interesting, isn't it? I don't think the free world can permit this to happen. It all depends on whether Europe presents a united front or not. Should some of these countries prefer to meet Russian terms rather than stick together in NATO and a united Europe, I honestly can't tell you what then might happen. After all, they are totally dependent in Europe on Arabian oil, as is Japan. We are in no position then to help them with oil as we always have with money, men, and munitions. And if they do not choose to fight for their own freedom, that will be up to them. Now look, I've talked a bit about myself. I'm going to talk about problems that are going to be yours. Give you a couple of examples. When do you want me off here, Bob? 10 minutes? 15 minutes? 10? Brup. I thank you. No. Well, I could. Except I'll brief this because I'm not going to read. I can't read this fast. We're going to lick this crisis as we've licked others. It really isn't a crisis. We Americans are a little bit quick to use superlatives. We always have the biggest and the littlest and the fattest and the skinniest and this and that. But the fact is we got a problem. And it's a sitch. I think we'll soon develop practical pollution-free methods of using the coal we've got, and we've got just one hell of a lot of it. Before this decade's over, I believe we've made tremendous advances in tapping the sun's energy and getting hydrogen out of the seawater, but they're both slow and they'll take a while. The sun and the sea, gosh, they put out enough energy in an hour, you know, to do our work for a year for us. Then we've got this atomic business that we've got run across a little setback on because it's dirty. But we, as you know, we've got that business where it generates, it keeps generating itself, something that I learned in physics was not possible. But the reason I'm confident that you'll do it, and I mean you, your generation, is that it's a challenge to you. And we've never missed out on a challenge. This country has never missed out. Any job, no matter what. In 43, President Roosevelt called upon the industrial scientific geniuses of the nation to join forces in unlocking the power of the atom. The call was answered, and the mystery of nuclear fission helped bring World War II to an earlier end. In 57, Eisenhower made a similar call for resolute action in challenging the threat posed by the Soviets when they launched the Sputnik. And you know what's happened there. You had one of the guys here, Armstrong, and a friend of mine, Neil. When John Kennedy put words to a dream and asked Congress to commit itself to the unbelievable challenge of placing a man on the moon before the decade was over, we did that. Again, the power structure of the nation joined forces in 69 and witnessed the one small step in putting a man on the moon. These were spectacular accomplishments. They are proof positive that change is constant, change is challenging, and that man is capable of meeting and beating most challenges. I go on here, and there's some figures, and I don't know that what'll run too long. It has to do with what's been accomplished in this century. It's a hell of a lot. Kids had an expectancy, a boy of 50 years and a girl 53. Now it's a boy 70, a man 70, and a girl 75. It was done by improving the food and water and shelter of our people and by improving our health care. I remember my grandma Hirsch used to take water when she would, bottled water, Poland water, when she traveled east. Because the water back east wasn't all that sick or anything. It just was different water and when the Washington crew came down to row against Cal, they used to bring their own water. So I don't know whether they thought the water at Berkeley was not good, but they brought their own anyway. Today we have pretty pure water around the country. I can't say that for the world. 3 years ago, there was one solitary death from something called botulism, you remember, which canned food made headlines from coast to coast. I remember it had something to do with tuna fish, I think, or whatever it was, I forget. Some special little can of food. Austin knows it because I was getting an eye operation at Johns Hopkins across the way, and damned if she didn't go in not knowing about this and ask him if they had any canned tuna fish. That morning's headline had said, all the tuna fish is poisoned. And the whole store broke out laughing, she said, or people around near, and she didn't know what they were laughing at. But now, there was one death. When I was a kid, millions of families canned their own food, and literally tens of thousands, this is off the record, not off the record here, I mean from the record, tens of thousands of cases of food poisoning occurred every year. Today, and forget about pollution, what the hell, we can live with carbon dioxide for a while. I'll tell you this, I hate to think if you had to have horses doing all of the work that the cars do, all the bugs and flies and smell and whatnot, it'd be a little worse. I can hear somebody saying, give me that good old smog. Get you there faster. And we'll solve it. May use a little more gas doing it with all those pollution attachments, but even so. When I was a little guy, I remember people wearing masks. There was a hell of a flu epidemic. More than 500,000 of our people died of this disease in one winter. The toll around the world was put by the Encyclopedia Britannica at more than 20 million. We still have outbreaks of the flu. It outbroke on me in Hong Kong, of all places, the other day. But you don't have an epidemic anymore. You don't have smallpox, diphtheria, typhoid, polio. Today, when I was a kid, they had 31 million people working. 3 million were unemployed, 10% of the workforce. You know what they are today. We have 89, 90 million people working, 5% unemployed. I claim that this is a whole hell of a lot in one, not me, not my generation, but since I've been alive anyway. Think of it, an annual average income in when I was born, in the turn of the century, a little thereafter, 20, 30 years thereafter, 8 or 10, the average income in this country was around $600. Now it's 10,000. The savings in the country were 2 billion, today it's 63 billion. Automobile, radio, telephone, airplane, computer, television, antibiotics. Trained and graduated more scientists, doctors, surgeons, dentists, lawyers, teachers, and engineers than did our forebears for 1,000 generations. Now this is interesting. I turn the page and I'll show you what I come to. That's always a little bit offsetting. Anyway, I don't mean to overemphasize what's been done, but I don't think we should minimize it either. I submit that this generation has not done as badly as some charge. Not too long ago, I sat out front with you. I don't expect to turn my suit in, but from now on, believe me, kids, this is your opportunity. You are coming to bat. And you might as well make plans for it, and you will make plans for it, and you'll make it. But don't think it's going to be a pipe. The world needs you, make no mistake about it. For you individually and collectively, are the future. You may not feel it, but you are. That's where tomorrow's world begins. It's up to you. I hope you enjoy your turn at bat as much as I have mine, and that's all there is. Thank you very much.
He said, I'm glad they didn't do that while I was talking. It's needless to say, you've already said thank you to him, and that's all I'm saying is thank you, and that's all there is.